Hello, and thank you for choosing this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. This is the latest podcast in a series connected to the Threat Horizon 2024 report. My name is Mark Ward. I'm a senior research analyst at the ISF. And in this podcast, we're talking about how one ISF member organization, MESC, uses the report and how it fits in with the other risk modeling work that MESC does. Here to talk about MESC experience is Amanda Hallett, Head of Strategic Risk and Foresight, and Karen Randwer, a cybersecurity risk manager who works alongside Amanda. Hello to you both, and thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Pleasure.
Also here is Paul Watts, a former CISO, a distinguished ISF analyst, and co-author of Threat Horizon 2024. Hello, Paul.
Do you know, I'm disappointed because I thought we were going to get ahoy there rather than hello from our Mariner colleagues. But I'll swallow my disappointment and we'll crack on.
We missed the boat on that one.
Oh, thank you.
That was good, Karen.
That was great. Yeah, we should pipe you aboard, shouldn't we? So brilliant. Just to get things going then, part of the reason we want to talk is because we are doing some work at the ISF just to find out how members use Threat Horizon. We have some of our own ideas, but always good to test those in the real world. So I'm curious about sort of more broadly the risk modeling work you do, sort of how you form MESC, how you come to terms with the problems, dangers, threats, etc. it poses. So if you can talk us through some of that first, that would be a great place to start, I think.
Yeah, sure. I mean, within MESC at the moment, we've got a few risk teams. So we've got my team that looks at the strategic outlook of risk management, and that really focuses on understanding and assessing and identifying the enterprise technology risks to MESC, as well as our forward-looking view of risks and opportunities, which Karen so greatly does. And then we have another team that looks after our operational risk management, so identifying, assessing, and managing operational risks that are your day-to-day risk management, and that's through standard methodologies, 5x5 matrices, and we also have a third party risk management team as well that sort of does the same thing as the operational risk management team, but with a slightly different angle, focusing on suppliers and also contracts. So we all work in a similar way, using the same type of methodology, likelihood times impact, but obviously myself, Karen, and the rest of the team very much focus on actually building a bit more of a proactive cybersecurity capability to cope with the constantly changing threat landscape that we have today, and help us be a bit more proactive rather than constantly being a bit on the back foot.
So it sounds like it's quite a big deal. Then there are a lot of risks that you guys, I guess you're huge and you have lots of very big ships and plants and machinery and things. So is that where this all comes from, or just that you're in a risky business generally, I suppose?
I mean, I guess so, but I think it's more to do with the threat landscape of cybersecurity. You know, it's constantly evolving, and as a company, we really need to work alongside that threat instead of responding to it. So myself, Karen, and the rest of the team providing that insight with to emerging risks and opportunities over a time horizon helps us as a business become a little bit more prepared. We can identify where we've got, you know, security gaps, standards, strategies, etc. Really focus our investments to help us be a bit more proactive rather than constantly responding to a threat as it becomes a reality. So I think we need to deal with the everyday, and we need to deal with the here and now, but we also need to be cognizant of the future and what that may bring to us as a company.
That's interesting, because I sometimes wonder about the types of risk organizations face and whether they're the same ones, because I talked to another ISF member, and they distinguish between active risks and the current risks.
Yep.
And the active ones are the ones that are kind of bubbling up and really, you know, in their face at the moment. Mm-hmm. And the other ones are the ones that are always there. So I guess you're on the cutting edge of those, or is it, you know, just, you know, those ones that you think you're trying to anticipate as much as anything else?
A little, yeah. I mean, there's an awful lot of risk. You know, MESC has many environments. We're not just shipping. We are an end-to-end logistics company. So there's operational technology environments, there's industrial environments, there's IT, you know, there's IoT. There's a lot of different types of companies that operate individually almost within our brand. And with that exposes us to not just a typical threat exposure of a specific industry. It actually exposes us to, you know, a multiplex of threats that we need to manage. So we have current risks that are your, you know, we need to deal with this potentially right now, and we will take a decision on that based on our risk methodology and the person that's accountable for that. But what we're doing is to really try and utilize the industry research that is out there to not predict, because we don't have a crystal ball, and we do say that a lot. We are not, you know, the
mystic meg of the cyber world.
Yeah, the mystic meg of the cyber world. But what we try to do is present the possible scenarios that could emerge based on the sort of geopolitical landscape that we face, and the different types of threats that we would be prevalent to the different areas that we operate in, to help us be a bit more prepared and proactive in our decision making.
Yeah. Just in terms of that, so I guess Maersk, and as with a lot of other bigger organizations, are finding that technology is almost overtaking their ability to learn and understand the, you know, the intersection between business and technology itself. How do you take technical risks within the threat landscape and articulate those in terms that senior leadership teams that may not be day-to-day involved in technology, and how do you make them relevant to them so that they understand and they can make informed decisions about what you're telling them?
Yeah, I mean, Karen, jump in at any point. I feel like I'm hogging the mic.
No, it's fine.
But the real value is to understand the so what. So why should they care? What is it that we are saying that is going to impact something that they care about? And actually, what does that mean in dollar value terms as well? Because we can say, oh, you know, there's a huge threat coming from Russia. These are the scenarios in which it may impact you. And they say, well, actually, they think, you know, none of that's related to me. I don't actually cover any areas of those business. So I'm going to switch off now. And only the people that care about it will understand. But once you have that dollar value introduced into the conversation, that's almost how
it's the attention grabber,
business talking. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's definitely key. I think when it comes to technical aspects of these things, it's a case of, it's the so what, but then it's that understanding and that resonating with what that actually means for the business. And 9 times out of 10, unless there's a monetary value on it, they're not going to care to some sort of degree. So once you can quantify that and put it into, as Amanda says, into dollar terms or pound terms, that's when you grab their attention. And that's when they're sort of like, well, hold on, maybe we should be investing in this a bit more. Maybe we should be looking into it a bit more deeper.
Yeah, and stop using acronyms. You know, you see so many acronyms. I had a conversation with actually my CISO only the other day, where he said, could you just actually refer to which one you mean, because there's 3 meanings for the same acronym in this business. Yeah. So you know, spell it out, talk to them in a language that they actually understand, and
just simplify, you know, it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, but I wonder if that monetary cutoff means that you don't warn them about some things because they don't cause a lot of monetary damage. I mean, is there a good filtering mechanism as well?
Well, I think the monetary value comes with assessing the impact in many different ways. So we would take into account reputational damage, commercial damage, you know, as well as pure financial damage, operational damage, legal, etc. So we can articulate that in many different forms. I think the greatest challenge, if I'm being honest, that Karen and I have is, because there are so many concerns of today, is actually getting people to give the right focus to the future, because it's almost one of those problems that you can put aside for another day because it's not relevant today almost. And there's so much more that is, especially with, you know, recent incidents like Log4j, SolarWinds, etc. There's something every day. So it's really trying to make the future relevant and give people the opportunity to understand how it can help them now for the future.
Yeah, I think it's changing that mindset of, I'll deal with it when it gets here. I've got enough problems right now, and avoiding that whole firefighting concept. It's like, everyone's, you know, it's not going to happen to us. It'll be fine. We'll deal with it when it gets here. Have that reactive approach. Why do that when you can put in the small steps now to either eliminate the risk or at least reduce it at the very least for when it does get there? Yeah.
innovation takes time as well. So if you need a big fancy solution, you need to implement something like, I don't know, enterprise DLP. You're not going to do that overnight. So you need to get ahead of it. You need to think about it.
Even things we've seen that were like 3-4 years ahead, they've catalyzed to come into play sooner. So although it can be, oh, we'll deal with it later, what if it turns up again in a few months' time? You'll be dealing with it a lot sooner than expected.
And I guess that's a strategic part of this, is you can step back and go, we're seeing 3 or 4 of the same kinds of things. So instead of seeing one fire, putting it out, oh, it's another fire. Oh, it looks very similar to the last fire we had. Then I guess you can, and then start that process. Because like you say, a big organization like Maersk, hard to turn around and hard to guide. So you have to, there's a lot of early work you have to do to get that, to start to make the turn.
I think as well, just on that, it just brings me to a sort of another point I think it's worth raising, in that, you know, risk doesn't all need to be doom and gloom. So one of the ways that we sort of articulate that to the business is, yes, this is a possible scenario that you could be faced with, but actually there's an opportunity here to get ahead of it. This is what this opportunity looks like. The opportunities can present in many forms. It could be a solution, etc. We can cost that, we can understand the return on investment, and we can really get ahead of understanding where that sits on the priority of everything that we need to do, and get it on there and still be proactive rather than being immediate.
I love that. You know, I think that's often been a problem that's held us back, in that we always talk about the things that can go wrong, and we talk about the bad, and people don't want to engage with that.
No.
And if we just reposition that language to talk about opportunity and business value, that's something that, I'm going to say it, it will float the boat of the execs, because they will want to talk to you about it. So actually, you know, this can add dollar value, drive revenue, drive innovation. And it is now not about worrying about what could, might, or will happen to us if we don't do A, B, and C. So I think changing the language, I think that's great.
I totally agree with you that word language changes everything. I mean, even from an awareness perspective, if you try and train employees to, you know, get their cybersecurity hygiene in order, if you do it from a scaremongering perspective, it puts them off because they think, oh, I could do something wrong. But if you flip it on its head and make them feel like they're doing something good for the business, and that they're doing something of value and rewarding them for those sorts of things in whatever way, even if it's just a well done email kind of thing, it just flips it on its head and makes it less negative and more positive. And it's the same thing when you go to the execs and the C-suite with that stuff.
I think, you know, that's literally the crux of how we sort of position what we do. It's not we're telling you to do to implement these solutions, and we're not telling you that you must mitigate this risk. We're providing you with the visibility and the transparency of the possible futures so that you can make the most informed decision about what you do with it.
Yeah. And I guess they don't have to set your advice. I mean, they could ignore you.
They could, totally. It would be wrong. Yeah. But no, I'm joking.
No, you're sitting there going, told you so.
I think we've done that a couple of times.
It is the secret sauce, though, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day, you have to remind yourselves, when we're having these conversations about risk and value, that it's not our business, and that we're providing a degree of facilitation and demystification of things that could or might happen to an organisation. Ultimately, the decision making, the power is in their hands, and you know, obsessing through what might or could happen, you know, that starts to drive the wrong sorts of conversations. And of course, the worst thing to do is use fear, uncertainty, and doubt as a blunt instrument to get your own way. That doesn't always work well. And strategically, it's not driving the sort of relationships that we desperately need with our businesses now.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think often in cyber, you know, you can get a bit blindsided by everything that encompasses working in this industry, and, you know, sort of forget that the business has a lot of other priorities to consider, and they have a lot of other things that they need to fund. So, you know, we very much, I guess, package this as a tool. So what we do provides you with the tools to make better and more informed decisions.
Do you find, Amanda, that you're leading the conversation, or have you found over time now that the business is actually coming to you saying, we're interested in, or we're thinking about, what are the things that we should be thinking about in terms of threat landscape? What could distract us? Are you seeing that kind of shift left and seeing your team being used more proactively rather than reactively?
Absolutely. I mean, Karen literally only had a conversation last night with a business stakeholder about that exact thing. And we've also had obviously within Maersk, we develop many products as well. So when that product life cycle is either starting or being reviewed for some reason, they come to our team proactively now to actually look at that requirement set against the future risks and opportunities to make sure that, you know, they're actually going into it with their eyes a bit more wide open.
I think that's quite key from our perspective as well. It's been refreshing to see people so open to it, because one of the key things we kept saying at the beginning of putting this tool together was it's about collaboration. We're not here to tell you what to do. We're trying to bring sort of a new form of intelligence to the table to help those informed decisions, as we keep saying.
To be honest with you as well, I used to get into lifts with people to make sure that they heard what I had to say. No, it's great that I don't have to do that, especially elevator with COVID.
You know, I don't struggle to disbelieve anything you just say. Just imagine, I was like, oh my God, I'm stuck.
The doors are closing. Yeah. Amanda's entered. Yeah.
Management by taking the lift, not by walking around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Around.
You know,
I'm going to call that the Hallett technique. Yeah.
Branded. Yeah.
Brilliant. But what drove that process and that change then? Was it providing the tool and I guess just demonstrating your value to other parts of the organization and then going, oh, you know what?
I think, you know, actually coming up with things that people resonate with and that they can understand, and, you know, we're calling out when things are a bit rogue. Yeah, we're calling it out. It's a wild card, but we want to include it for these reasons, and having that real rationale behind what you're actually delivering and actually involving those stakeholders throughout the entire process. You know, it's something that we do repeatedly at discovery, at delivery. We have stakeholder sets that we would, you know, review that with. We would ask them for their opinion, for their input to that, so that they feel like a part of the process, so that when it gets delivered, they think, yeah, I contributed to that.
It you doesn't know, just get shelved.
100%. So I think that's really brought people on board, because, you know, we started with nothing. We didn't have a proactive capability in that sense. And the first year, if I'm honest, was sort of introducing the concept. And the second year was growing it. And when you see the results of, okay, well, we've identified 20 gaps in policy, for example, that says something, and it allows you to take action, or allows you the option of taking action. And for C-suite employees or execs, you know, it's really powerful analysis, because it's that zoomed out view instead of seeing things so zoomed in all the time. Vulnerability, vulnerability, vulnerability. No, this is what it all means. Big picture.
Yeah. I think even last year we had, I think it was about 35 risks and ops that we identified in the space of 7-8 months, I think it was, that we'd put out there with about 47 different proposed solutions. This year, it's almost doubled in numbers of how many risks and ops we've identified so far. So it just shows that contribution from all the other angles and getting those other lenses makes such a difference, because we've got the sort of information from the trenches now as well, specifically to say what those actual risks are for them. And they're actually getting more and more involved and coming to us personally and saying, can we have a conversation about X, Y, and Z? I think it would be good for the tool that you guys have put together. So it's great. It's a great collaboration tool.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that, actually. Just a more topical question. So obviously, we've just been through a fairly significant black swan event in terms of the global pandemic. How did your team, without obviously going into operational details, of course, but how did your team work in the early stages of your Maersk's response to the coronavirus pandemic? And what have you learned going forward for any future scenario planning that you will do?
Well, so if it's fair to say, we worked hard.
Imagine.
Yeah, we worked hard. No, but there was a lot of teams that were working, bending over backwards, to be honest, to make sure that things were, you know, available, uptime, minimal disruption, so that we could get people working. Also, I think, you know, a lot of efforts to the mental health aspect as well, for a company to suddenly shift from predominantly working in the office 24/7. It was quite rare, to be honest, to work from home, to shifting to being at home all the time and really having that disconnect from people was a real thing and a real struggle for many people across the company. So I think that the mental support that was provided as an executive organization was fantastic, and that was definitely needed, wasn't it, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say I joined Maersk mid-pandemic, and I don't think I was missing anything at all. There's nothing that I could have asked for more that could have been done aside from that face-to-face interaction in person, which we eventually got anyway a couple of months later. But yeah, honestly, I wasn't missing anything.
I think it was just really, you know, interesting as well, because, you know, dealing with the pandemic itself, obviously there was a lot of technical things that we needed to deal with to enable our employees with that, but of course from a cyber perspective, the threat profile literally just shot up with things that, you know, we weren't typically focusing on because it wasn't such a priority. So other things became newly important to us, or more important than before, with things like VPN, RDP, etc. And it really shone a light on actually our ability to respond to those things very quickly, which was fantastic. Maybe had something to do with the fact that, you know, we had some good preparation from the 2017.
Wasn't going to bring it up.
I thought we'd get through one thing without it.
Yeah, wasn't going to bring it up. But there you go.
Does it? But no, I think, you know, dealing with that from a cyber organizational perspective and the new threats that occurred with that, and communicating to the business with the newfound threats and actually the fact that they were targeting more so employees more than ever, et cetera, and helping them understand what to look for, the best practices to do when they are working from home, was a real effort. So, yeah.
And how did you strike the balance? So I'm interested in, obviously, organisations have that immediate short-term response. So we've got to send everybody home. I think in terms of Maersk global operations, I can't even begin to think about the challenges that threw up. But when you then realised that this was going to not be a one-month period of disruption or a three-month period of disruption, this was more like 12 to 18 months, did your organisation then start to think about those longer term potential threats born from the coronavirus pandemic, so you could start to think about things that you would have to do in the medium to long term, as well as the topical stuff about getting people working from home, worrying about you know, changes in security posture because people were working on unsecured networks, et cetera, et cetera. Well, how did you strike the balance between short range and long range?
I think, to be honest with you, our corporate central corporate teams really helped with that. So, you know, we have a corporate risk team. They have emerging risks on their radar for the organization. Obviously, we focus purely on technology cyber, but they have that on there. And as part of that typical process, we have crisis management team, and that is a really great capability that stood up to look at both short term and long term. So, you know, there's different teams that focus on different things with different priorities, because obviously what's relevant for the short term may not actually be the answer for the long term, and making sure that the time and the relevant priority that's needing to give to those conversations is provided by the execs. So I think it's really interesting because, you know, a lot of things have been accelerated because of the pandemic, which perhaps were on the roadmap anyway. Did they have the same priority? I'm not sure. But a lot of things have been accelerated. But I think also a lot of interesting conversations, which I've not been privy to, have happened around the strategic direction that we want to take technology in, et cetera, and what that looks like, and also the business as a result of this. So it's overall been a positive experience from that perspective.
Cool, great answer, thank you.
Interesting. I'm just slightly conscious of time, so just to sort of drag things screaming back to Threat Horizon and things like that. So, because it sounds like as an organisation, you're pretty sorted out, and, you know, obviously Threat Horizon, the dangers we expose in that contribute to that strategic look at, you know, where threats might come from. But I just wonder, for you guys, what's next? Are there still some things to fix? It sounds like you've got a pretty good handle on your risks. There's obviously a lot of them, and you're clearly the busiest people on the planet. But is there, what, you know, where else can you take it? What else can you do with that risk modeling and management?
Oh, there's so much. Honestly, Karen yeah. and I are sad creatures, aren't we? Because we literally wake up in the middle of the night.
I've
now sleep with a notebook next to my bed so I can write down the ideas, and we'll ring each other and say, oh, I had a thought.
I've just had an idea.
Yeah. Get a life. But no, there's much more that we want to do. I mean, just as for an example, this year, obviously, we use reports like the Threat Horizon to identify and validate sort of the outputs that we've used. We also use other industry reports as well. But we only obviously take what's relevant to our industry, what's relevant to our environments. Not everything is, of course. So when we do that, we do our own assessments to understand, you know, the likelihood and the impact of that, whether it be a risk or an opportunity. And then for what is probable, we do some modeling with the FAIR methodology to really understand that sort of risk curve of loss and the value that that may present. So we need to, you know, get a better handle on that, because at the moment we can only do what we can for the probable sphere, because we don't have enough power, to be honest, because it takes time to do that analysis. And I don't know if you've seen the WEF sort of strategic intelligence interactive it's like a, what is it, online tool, Karen? I can't really describe this.
Oh,
like
it's the World Economic Forum. Yeah.
Yeah. Acronym. God, my own worst enemy there. But, you know, at the moment, we've got an interactive capability to a point, so that, you know, people can sort of play around with the tool. But, you know, that could improve, definitely.
Yeah.
Just maybe one final question, conscious of time, before Mark shouts at me. To organisations who are thinking that they need to go down this route and they're starting to look at products like Threat Horizon, what would the first and most important piece of advice you would give them before embarking on such a journey?
To be honest, I'd probably give a couple.
That's allowed.
Yeah. I'd first say, you know, you've really got to think about delivering the business an output that they're going to recognize. So really, you need to focus first on the strategic objectives of the business and understand what the potential futures could be in relation to that. You know, we need to keep it high level. I would say don't overcomplicate it for the first time that you're sort of you know, attacking this in that sense, because you can literally go down a rabbit hole and come out at the other end of the globe, to be honest. So keep it high level, put a scope on it, show that you can prove value before you go further. Because I think, you know, to fail fast is wrong at this point, because once you fail with the concept, it's going to die. So that's a bit doom and gloom, but it really is a valuable tool, and to show that value straight up and the examples of how it can provide the organization with that sort of added proactive capability is really valuable. Karen,
I think for me the key word is collaboration. So just get everyone on board if possible. Try and find the value that everyone is going to get from it and get them involved. The more people feel involved and a part of something and that they've contributed to it, the more they're going to commit to it, the more they're going to be receptive to that and to the information that you're giving them. Without that, it's just going to be another thing on a shelf that you've put hours and hours into and just doesn't get anything out of it. So collaboration.
What, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So totally. What?
Yeah, it's a question we ask while we're writing Threat Horizon. Yeah, so who cares about this? So why should we include this? It's certainly a good.
Yeah, and what does your organisation care about as well? So, you know, we're quite fortunate or unfortunate. I don't know. Depends on your view, that we're not a highly regulated industry. So we have the ability to take more risk based decisions. We're not necessarily driven by regulatory requirements and other sort of mandatory things, so we have that opportunity. But if your organization is more heavily driven through controls, then make sure that you're mapping things in a way that they will understand why it's actually relevant to yourself. So if you need to map emerging risks against NIST categories or domains, and you can really show where you need to build maturity to perhaps deal with that, and you can compare that against your current organizational profile, then that's a tool that can be used, you know. So think about actually, where's this going to make a difference? Because it's not going to make a difference just, you know, sort of displaying things on a page, and it's interesting and it will spark conversation, but where's it going next? What's the actual element of what you're producing that can be used as a tool?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's great advice to make it actionable, and certainly we're keen to do that for Threat Horizon. Just make sure it lands right and people can take it and see the value of it as well. Yeah. That's important for us all. Thank you, Amanda. Thanks, Karen. Thanks, Paul, as well. And thanks, everybody else, for listening. You can find more podcasts on the ISF podcast channel or at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research tools and guidance.